Arthur Croker is joining us tonight. He is the Canadian Research Chair at the Pacific Center for Technology, Culture, and Theory, Professor of Political Economy. His books, Will to Change and Culture of Nihilism, and his newest book, Life in the Wires. Tonight, we're really just going to be kind of listening in on these mavericks talk about our digital selves, what we need to understand. That I might, you know, come in every once in a while and say something, but really, I know that for some of us, we're like still just not, you know, necessarily getting the importance of media. And that's just because we swim in it and we don't understand how it augments our body, how it creates desires and creates creates new appetites for that culture. But maybe some of that will be clarified tonight with our two genies on the line. So first and foremost, let's welcome to KPFK Bob. Bob, dear, thank you so much for joining us here again on KPFK.
My pleasure, Evan.
Yes.
And we're honored to have Arthur again.
Absolutely. Let me get Arthur on the airwaves with us. Mr. Croker, fantastic for you to join us here again tonight.
Well, it's a great pleasure.
Absolutely, sirs. All right. And so I know that Bob has a specific direction to take this conversation. And so, Bob, take it away.
Okay, Arthur, in your essay, The Born-Again Ideology, you point out that this is the 100th anniversary, 2005, of Einstein's theory of relativity and also Max Weber's anniversary of the Protestant ethic. That book and Einstein's theory. This applies to, according to your essay, the United States.
Yep.
Would you include North Canada in this, or is it America, the United States in particular?
No, I think in this time, and Canada standing off to the side, actually. This is a truly American story.
Right. So, Eben, listen to this. This is what Arthur says in this essay. He says, long before Einstein's scientific vision of relativity theory, America always was a quantum country. A culture of communication, it has always privileged the speed of light as the emblematic sign of its technological omnipotence. Then skipping down a little bit, he says, the signs of quantum America as simultaneously waveform and particle, opposite changes of cultural state simultaneously, are everywhere. Symbolically, it's the split visual energy field of the American flag with its stars and stripes. Historically, it's the received interpretation of the Civil War as a redemptive moral struggle fusing opposing violent energy states, Confederates and Unionists, in the continuing story of the American Republic. And he goes on to the quantum nature of the legislature, of the culture, and a few other aspects. We won't go into all of them, but Arthur, could you explain why you see that the quantum theory that came out of Einstein was already prefigured in the setup of American culture 200 years before, if that's not too difficult in this kind of medium?
Yeah. The essence of Einstein's quantum physics was a notion that you would have, that life would move in simultaneously very paradoxical ways, that it would simultaneously be a waveform and it would be form a pattern at the same time. In other words, you could have violent motion at the same time as you could have sort of a static waveform or a pattern. And my theory about America is this, that, you know, really coming out of the rubble of Europe in the age of progress, that what really was invented in America was not simply, you know, the forced kind of white settler colonization against indigenous cultures of what became the American landscape, but was in fact like a new metaphysical idea which became, you know, really the American dream. And the essence of this is, in fact, like a very unique formula, which is really at the center made American empire. That is, that this is one culture that would take two things which always are held in absolute opposition. For example, a culture which is simultaneously driven to Puritanism on the one hand and driven to forms of consumer excess on the others, which is religious on one hand, which is deeply secularist in its culture on the other hand, which, for example, and going back to the Civil War, is, you know, a war of, like, massive, very bleak, sacrificial violence on the one hand, and then is instantly recuperated later, like in, you know, the films about the Civil War, as, like, a redemptive struggle and a source of unification of American empire. basically the basis of American political ideology is something that the world has never seen before, and that is you take a quantum idea, you take opposite field forces and hold them in tension and hold them in stability, and you allow them to flip back and forth. It creates a culture of, you know, incredible ecstatic energy, you know, incredible violent energies on the one hand, and on the other hand, it has a culture which has about it something which is immensely ancient. It can be deeply, deeply religious on the one hand, as on the other hand, it can be increasingly a really nihilistic culture. You can have Cheney this week, for example, you know, pleading, you know, putting out a plea to Republican senators to allow the, you know, security forces to carry on torture on the world at one and the same time.
Okay, now, Evan, what we have here is the quantum theory, the oscillating between waveform and particle, it's more than schizophrenia, isn't it, Arthur?
Yeah, I don't think it's schizophrenia at all. I think it's really just, it's a culture, what I would call a culture of twisted strands. It's really a very unique formula, which, you know, comes out of like metaphysics, on like a cultural metaphysics, and finds its way into the logic of war, into the logic of economy, of a culture of the media itself. It's a culture which is, you know, simultaneously like waveform and has real patterns, and at the same time it can fragment in many different ways and holds both opposites in like a kind of stability, actually, and the field can shift back and forth. It's quite a, you know, there's no other country in the world that can do this as uniquely as the United States. It's a very, very distinctive metaphysic.
Right, so it is actually, I think I read in Spasm, you end talking about United States as the first virtual country. It is actually virtual reality 200 years ago.
Yeah, I think so.
Right, so it leads to a further statement you have here, a nation of possibilities. This is really interesting. The idea of the American dream. That means a nation of quantum possibilities, of potentialities.
Yeah.
A country of probabilities, which absorbs the difference. Mm-hmm. America is and has always been a historical singularity, a quantum culture. And this is the new element here, a space-time fabric. Breaking with European binary discourse, America has always represented a fusion of pre-Enlightenment subjectivity and post-human technology, just waiting to happen.
Yeah.
Now, this applies to the theme of the Bush era, your next statement. Where did this, you know, pre-Enlightenment, born-again Christianity, this Puritan ethic, where did this come all of a sudden back on the scene? You explain it this way. Consequently, if Einstein's special theory of relativity could speculate that light is both waveform and particle simultaneously, that light is both and opposite states simultaneously, that is only to repeat the political formula that has animated American political culture from its Puritan beginnings, namely that this would be a culture simultaneously of redemptive violence and panic insecurity.
Yeah.
Now, Evan, is there anything you want to say about this as you hear it?
Yes. Mr. Croker, is this a natural outgrowth from the idea of a homogeneous versus heterogeneous society where you have all of these cultures coming and you needed to, in a sense, and all this tension that comes? It seems like it's a mechanism of breaking down tradition and also creating a control structure at the same time. Does that have anything to do with what you are seeing in the American society?
Well, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's the idea of the American mosaic. And that is, your analysis is really eloquent, and it's true. That, I think, comes later, actually. I think the story of this really goes back to the Puritans, I'm really very fascinated with.
Yeah, maybe you could explain the redemptive violence and panic insecurity as expressed in the famous statement by John Winthrop when he was coming across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, this is the notion, you know, the Mayflower Compact. You know, the boat is sitting in the middle of, you know, is approaching American shores in the middle of the American, middle of the ocean itself. The Mayflower Compact is made, if you go to the actual text of the Mayflower Compact, it's very interesting. Because, you know, the declaration is made and the loyalty oaths are sworn by everyone that they'll be loyal to this land, which will become a land of God, you know, the promised land, which, you know, if they act correctly, will have about a great redemption. It'll be really the promised land itself. It will be the new Jerusalem. But there's a line in that that's not much noticed. And, that, you know, this first line is really always noticed. You know, it's because it's the American, it's the city of the light and the hill. But the line after that is not much noticed and has, and if we fail in this task, you know, we will be cast out by God and we will be made to suffer iniquity and we will have lost, you know, the fortunes of the good land itself. you know, we will suffer the fall.
Hmm.
When I read that, I thought, wow, you know, really deep in the metaphysics, like really deeply in the mind of the Puritans, is this notion of the rise and the fall, of control and fragment control, not just of a society, but really disciplinary, aesthetic, sexual control of oneself on the one hand, you know, and then the possibility of the fall and the fragmentation on the other hand. And as soon as this strange group, you know, wades out of the shore at Plymouth Rocks and comes on, you know, Plymouth Rock and comes on shore itself, they just take this immense violence which is in their body and direct it first against themselves in terms of a, like a very, very austere, cynical, tight form of sexual austerity and austerity of their, you know, disciplining of their bodily practices. And then they project it on the world in terms of immense violence directed against indigenous people and against the land itself. So I really go back to the Puritans for this story of both end, this story of immense, you know, austere discipline which is directed against oneself and in the name of redemption, and a kind of violence which is directed on the society for the purpose of control itself. You know, things must not allow it to be fragmented.
Is this Puritan ethic internalized and then projected, is this a product of the life that they had underneath a feudal system where they were felt to be lesser than, and are they constantly trying to, in a sense, become human after living within a system that showed them as cattle, in a sense?
Oh, I think that's really good. Yeah, it's really based on, the Puritans were not modern. I mean, most people like America to be like a modern country, and I don't agree with that. I think it's the most ancient of all countries.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Puritans themselves had an ancient mentality. If you read, like, their, you know, their diaries that they kept in the world in the Massachusetts Bay Colony in Plymouth Rock, if you read what they were saying to one another on the ship and then go back to the archives of the Puritans themselves, their minds were really, you know, New Testament minds and the oldest sort itself. And they viewed, you know, the upstarts of, you know, the Church of England sliding backwards to Catholicism, the hierarchy, and, you know, the kind of resentment when they were in Holland and Amsterdam, you know, the forced kind of pilgrimage that they were forced to make. So this immense resentment in their body and resentment, and thought that they themselves were the restoration of the idea of the New Testament, of the coming of the Lord himself.
Mm-hmm.
So most people take America to be, like, at its foundations, like, you know, the modern idea of a culture, and I don't really agree. This is the most ancient, you know, breath of ancient air, which is being breathed into a new continent, really, in the language of the Puritans. And when I see the Puritans coming out of the sea at Plymouth Rock, I don't really see modern creatures that are modern beings.
Right.
I see really post-human beings, actually. They're not humans. They're post-human already. They've really moved into another space, and they're a peculiar kind of personality because they hold two ideas which are opposite in their minds simultaneously. They hold very ancient religious ideas, you know, the canonical texts of the New Jerusalem, you know, really the psychogeography of the mind frame that they bring to the country itself.
Mm.
And at the same time, they have really an absolute adaptability to the use of modern technology itself, you know, to the instruments of capitalism, to the uses of technology as ways to exploit the land and exploit themselves.
Mm.
And that would move to eventually to the post-human. They were already ready for it.
Yeah. Well, I think they were post-human when they walked out of the sea, actually. They were
right.
Really alien creatures.
Right. Now, I'm going to develop that a little later, just to carry this on the next stage. So Arthur writes, and if Einstein could theorize against and beyond Newton's modernist vision of an entitative universe where discrete objects interact at a distance, that he would go beyond that and that we live in a space-time fabric moving at the speed of light. This was only to repeat what had long been established in the founding covenant of the United States, namely that this good land, in the words of the Mayflower Compact, was visualized from its historical inception as an imminently religious, imminently unified fabric of space-time moving literally at the transcendental speed of light, but theological light. You like that, Evan?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, how does this come back in the beginning of the 21st century? So Arthur writes, and if quantum theorists after Einstein could theorize that implosive change that occurs in quantum culture by virtue of a tunneling effect, you've heard of that, the tunneling effect?
Yes.
Whereby warp holes suddenly and unpredictably open up in the space-time fabric, linking singularities from the past and the future, that is exactly what is occurring in the politics of American empire today. Here, a religious singularity from the past, the Puritan origins of faith-based politics, has now literally tunneled its way into the future. Fueled by the born-again emotions of religious pre-modernity, the American cybernetic post-human opens onto a future in which atavistic, or old, religious impulses stream across the space-time fabric of a technoculture moving at the speed of digital light. If this appears contradictory, paradoxical, indeterminate, that is probably because America is the first and definitely most singular expression of the quantum idea politically realized. Now, isn't that original?
That I'd have to hear that whole thing again, but maybe Arthur can break down.
Yeah, replay the tunneling effect, Arthur.
Yeah,
the tunneling effect is that if you really think quantum physics and you think of America and you think, well, America's not like from its inception, it's not a modern country in any sense. You know, it really breaks with the European idea and starts something. You know, it really is at its inception a postmodern country and in the really authentic sense of the term, it's a post-human country. This means that it's true language of science that governs the country is never like a Newtonian science where space and time are held to be opposite things and, you know, you stand outside of it like an antedate of the universe. But instead, America, in its psychogeography, in its feedback loops of communication, in its economy and in its culture, really is a unified space-time fabric. It moves at the speed of light. I mean, that's such a truism that's sort of like naturalized in everyone's language of perception and bodies. We live in like a televisual electronic culture, which is to say we live in a culture which moves perceptually at the speed of light and we just take it for granted.
Yeah, but may I ask, why did the Puritans play so heavily upon the consciousness of New America? Why did that reverberate so much? Why did they come to think that they really had something to say about how the culture should see itself?
I think what resonates with Puritanism is a doubled language. It's a language of the possibility of redemption on the one hand, the possibility of, you know, the recovery of a lost theological idea of hope in this good land. It becomes, in many ways, you know, the basic credo of so many forms of American religion, from Pentecostal, evangelical, to Orthodox religion in America. But it's coupled with something else, which is a language of ressentiment, a fundamental hatred of existence, which is based on a hatred against oneself for being a human being in the first instance.
Yes.
I think these two things held in combination, like some likely paradoxical combination, are the animistic force of American personality. Hatred of existence on the one hand, and a really overwhelming strong desire for redemption on the other. And the hope that you'd find redemption personally, but you always find it, of course, in the collective. You know, every presidential speech will end, of course, you know, God bless America, God bless the American people.
Mm.
It's the benediction.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County. Can you believe that 20 minutes has already gone by in speaking with these two genies? That is what happens when there is a tunneling effect on the radio here, and we are sitting in with Bob Dobbs out of New York, with Arthur Croker out of Canada, and we are melding together your experiences of life and maybe some of the behavioral modifications that have been made to you through the Puritan ethic, along with quantum physics, quantum, everything at once, polar opposites existing. This is going to be broken down tonight even more by our special guests, Arthur Croker and Bob Dobbs. We just need to take a very quick break, darlings, and we're going to be hot and back into this subject matter. So stay tuned, okay?
Radio Alchemy.
Eclipsing conventional wisdom. All alchemists converge at www.radioalchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
And we're back, loves, on the lines. Bob Dobbs, our genie of media ecology, and also Arthur Croker, who is the Canadian Canada Research Chair at the Pacific Center for Tech, Culture, and Theory, also the editor of Sea Theory, an amazing site. If you want to, exercise your synaptic gaps in a different way, please check out seatheory.com.
.net.
And he is the professor of political economy, and I believe we are discussing one of his books, maybe this one, Life in the Wires. But Bob, take it away. Where would you like to go now?
Yeah, we're not doing his book. We're doing an article that's on seatheory.net called The Born Again Ideology.
Great.
Now, the other anniversary of 2005, the 100th anniversary of Max Weber's Protestant Ethic, subtitled Arthur, The Spirit of Capitalism, right?
Yep.
He says that the model of the modernist period of capitalism environment was explained by Max Weber, but we have flipped out of that into a new Protestant ethic, and this is eventually going to lead to Arthur's concept that the Puritans are post-human aliens, almost vampires. We've explained the Einsteinian level of America as a quantum country. Now we're going to go into the Protestant ethic and how that the new Protestant ethic leads to the biometric state, which has come in since September 11th. I don't have any quotes on that one right here, Arthur. Would you like to explain that term and some of the characteristics of the biometric state?
Yeah, the new biometric state is the notion that the power today doesn't reside outside the body, but power today, which is really to navigate inside the body as tightly as possible, wants to keep the body under tight surveillance and to really position the body in sort of feedback loops. So the body is kept in a permanent state of panic fear on the one hand and panic insecurity on the other, and both are politically played off against one another quite logistically almost, quite coldly by the state.
Right. Now, you proposed in an earlier article I read that the anti-environment to this is the meaning of the title of your book, Life in the Wires, the new book, a collection of articles featured on seatheory.net over the last few years.
Yeah.
And you talk about it as remix theory. Let's give people an antidote to the biometric state, which you propose with remix theory.
Yeah, well, remix theory is my sense that if you go to the world like of sampler music and of hip-hop and, of art, culture, William Burroughs' notion of cut-ups, there's really a continuous strand of really liberatory thought found in the arts and culture itself, and it's basically based on the notion of remix itself. It's an attempt, to live critically in a contemporary culture which is suffocating people by not seeking the kind of false escapes from it, by doing exactly the opposite. That is, entering into it as deeply as possible but maintaining a continuously kind of poised standpoint and beginning to do cut-ups and remixes of the culture, beginning to brush things against them, doing, perform sort of unlikely juxtapositions itself. With someone like Burroughs, like William Burroughs, one of my, favorite poets and writers and, wordsmiths, would do this all the time. Like in his Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving prayer for America, which is like church music in the background. And the text itself is like this immensely bleak text, like a nation of thinks and stuff, in which he just sort of rubs, one word against the other. And, within the context, the somber context of the church music itself, it has this really evocative effect of, just really beginning to enunciate sort of a hidden truth within the culture. Mm-hmm. And sampler musicians like DJ Spooky, that's the beloved old kid, do this all the time. They're fantastic music. There's lots of musicians and artists and, video makers and cineasts who really are like remix artists. And I think they're the one hope that really stands against, the hegemony of the new biometric state.
May I ask, in the idea of remix, I know that Bob speaks highly about the idea that today's media is going to be, in a sense, in a review mirror and will become, in a sense, I'm not saying this completely correct, Bob, but I guess I'm getting to the point of if we're at a remix and postmodern, what voices? I mean, it seems like we're saying that all the voices and everything has been heard, so all we can do is to revamp and recombine and do the past to try and make something new. Where is the idea of innovation and breaking outside of what we, you know, out of what we know. Where is the new? Do we have a death of the imagination so that we just have to go and rehash and recombine the old?
Yeah, but I don't think remix is rehashing the old at all. I think it's quite the opposite. Just sort of uses the, you know, it's like with Donna Haraway, you know, the California theorist, who calls situated knowledge, when you live in a culture which is, you know, she describes an information of dominance. That is, the, you know, your real material existence is actually like a media culture and the events that happen to you, the kind of news that you hear on, you know, the day and things like this.
Right.
But what's entirely new is like an always changing aesthetic attitude and a political attitude. That is, how do you take your actual everyday world experience and begin to transform it in really transformative creative directions itself? And that's what I would mean by, you know, like, remix is like a comportment towards civilization, a comportment towards technology itself. It's absolutely material and situated on the one hand, and it's transformative on the other. It's like a paradoxical form of action.
And what transformative effect do you think it has in a media environment where you're bombarded and oversaturated by input, and it's forgotten pretty quickly?
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, I mean, we look at some of the, you know, we look at Katrina, we look at Indonesia, we look at things that really, outside art, that really have impact, and maybe things that don't get the radio play, et cetera. I'm really talking about, like, somebody being able to create this, but then for it to be heard, to have, to share that, because art is made to be shared, to have that transformative effect, and with the fleeting nature of information and the overload of the information overload of the information age, it's the stickiness that's so important.
Well, no, that's really good. Yeah, and it's sort of like the attack on memory is like a real method of political control today, eh?
Right.
Like it's really like with Katrina. I mean, what happened to all the African Americans in Katrina?
What happened to all the whites in Biloxi, Mississippi? I mean, we didn't even get to hear about them. We got to see the Africans for, I think, political reasons, but not the whites that were devastated in that.
And they're literally evaporated from existence itself.
Right, exactly.
In the same time, like a planning process put down to move these places in like the new Disney Worlds of America or something of the sort, you know, if you see what HUD's up to in terms of their, you know, like they're doing, going to do to what they want to do to Iraq, they're going to do to New Orleans and things like this.
Yes.
It's completely true that in the one that you're confronted with a culture which is vampirish, because it's not normal culture, it's a culture of evaporation and disappearances. Just, you know, really cynical and cold and cruel on the one hand.
Right.
But I would say that one thing that musicians and artists and writers and just people, you know, with critical imaginations do, and it's probably the most potent political act at the start that one can do today, is simply the act of remembrance itself.
Right.
And what I mean by remix culture is really a culture which is about remembrance.
Very good.
It's a situated knowledge which recalls events like Katrina and then really just begins to transform them, which we do in our imagination, into trying to think through what are the critical meaning and what are the actual meanings of this and what are possibilities for action.
Isn't there something beyond the waveform and the static point of quantum physics? Isn't there something then that is added that summation brings us to a whole different understanding of the universe? And isn't that where we need to be also? Is in a sense a breakthrough?
Oh, yeah, that's nice. Yeah. So why not a form of paradoxical thought for a culture that tries to crush paradox, basically?
Yes.
And I really would encourage like paradoxical forms of thought that hold opposites in motion and things like this, which are transformative in character.
And that's just what our political process really could go through. It would be really great to stop these so-called Democrat-Republican opposites and smash them into something.
Yeah, that's exactly true. In the red states versus the blue states, and you know these basically mirrored sides of the new security state, which sort of imitate one another and just sort of flip their logic and, you know, get voting blocks to one side or the other and things like this. Yeah, a form of thought which was delirious and paradoxical and critical and fully creative and fully filled with remembrance at the same time as fully filled with, you know, human aspirations for new possibilities would be something that would be in the middle of this culture, actually.
Yes.
But it's crushed.
Yes. Bob?
Okay. Let's remember Jean Baudrillard, very influential thinker who developed from McLuhan and influenced Arthur. I want to go back to some statements he made and see if it is relevant to what Arthur is saying now. In 1986, 87, when The Postmodern Scene came out, Arthur, you wrote that when technology in its ultra-modernist phase connects again with the primitivism of mythic fear turned radical, it's no longer the Baudrillardian world of the simulacrum and hyperrealism, but a whole new scene of virtual technology and the end of the fantasy of the real.
Yeah.
Now, has Baudrillard ever spoke to you, and would he agree with you or disagree with you? Because he does use the word virtual a lot in his 90s writings.
Yeah, we'd sort of have a different idea on this, I think, actually.
All right, so you would still stand that there's some newer scene that he's not dealing with.
Oh, yeah, primitivism, actually.
He's not dealing with, even though he's a postmodern primitive,
But
there's a new kind of primitivism?
Yeah, well, I don't know if his thought has ever really appreciated as deeply the religious character of society.
And
the question of how religion brushes up against the question of technology. And I don't just mean in America. Many, many countries, like India, for example. In India is a country where you have, you know, until recently the ruling party was the BJP. The BJP was really an interesting party because it was a party, on the one hand, of Hindu fundamentalism, like really reactionary Hindu fundamentalism on the one hand. But it was also the party, it was like a Silicon Valley party. They put into effect public policies. The program was called the India Shining Program. Set up the base for like a computer industry in Bombay, and you know, which has become like a real success story in those terms in India itself. So here you really have, you know, like another parallel story of this relationship between religion and technology. It's primitivist in terms of its real fundamentalist religious sensibility on the one hand, and it's really expansive and globalizing in its adoption of, you know, new technocratic possibilities on the other. It's like hyper-technological and hyper-primitive both at the same time.
Right. Is that what you meant back in C-Theory about 1990? You said that that's what Twin Peaks resonated with. It brought in that theme.
That certainly did, actually.
Yeah, hyper-rationalism and the primitive fear?
Yeah, it's the American idea.
Right. But you see it happening all over the place.
Yeah, no, because that's the notion of the space notion of, like, if I take Einstein really seriously, I think what was the 100th anniversary of Einstein? The publication of his three great essays and things like this in 1905. And it's not just like a nominal century of Einstein. Einstein's idea really, you know, really anticipated the movements of culture. Culture literally with the electronic age has become, you know, very practically a space-time fabric. And that's what the story of electricity is. When culture becomes literally reorganized, this is space-time fabric, and you have like a culture of informatics, media which moves at the speed of light, financial capital which just sort of globalizes and circulates around the world, you know, just in instance. And you have face-to-face communications of people thousands of miles away from one another, never seen one another, but their actions in their lives or their societies affect one another. Then all the rules of quantum physics apply. Rules which you would think were just the language of science, like singularities and tunneling effects and movements at the speed of light, and, you know, these paradoxical forms of existence where you have waveforms and patterns and particles existing at simultaneously at the same time, those cease to belong simply to the language of science. And I believe they've become like the everyday language of politics and culture and society and sexuality and bodies itself. We really do live in a space-time fabric. Now, it's a long-winded way of saying that if that is true, then what is also anticipated by quantum physics is probably a better way to understand our contemporary politics and culture. And that is, its movements are no longer like teleological, like oriented towards a goal in the distance. They're no longer really instrumental. They're really governed by singularities. Space-time fabrics, things change in space-time fabrics when singularities open up, holes open up, you know, points of violent energy open up in the web of the space-time fabric, and they can open up anywhere, just paradoxically. You can have like a hurricane hitting the coast of, you know, southern United States and New Orleans, and suddenly you don't just have a story of the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. You really have a story of the social devastation of American culture and these, you know, the violent effects of really right-wing policies in America and a kind of psychogeography of disappearance and evaporations of human beings. I mean, it's a much more global story. Tonight as we talk, the suburbs of Paris and 307 cities in France are burning tonight. Some like 1,900 cars have been set on fire over the last week. Policemen are shot. You know, it's like this singularity has opened up. and it reveals, you know, to give a culture of 5 million Muslim people living in France, they've always been treated as, you know, absolutely second-rate citizens. There's virulent racism within the culture itself. And I'd say that this story is not a story unique to France. It's a story of the European, the future of the European community itself, of like, it's like a Katrina effect in Europe itself. It's like unmasked the European community and, you know, its desires for like the new digital citizen and be like a transcendental alternative to the United States itself. So singularities can open up at any point. They're violent and they bring together the past and the future simultaneously in very unpredictable and curious ways itself. Now, for myself, I think that's a much more realistic way of understanding the culture within which we live. And to do that is mean study the language of science, study the language of, you know, singularities and how what happens when you become a culture moving at light speed.
Right. Now, in the book Possessed Individual, you have an essay on Baudrillard, and you say Baudrillard's missing twin star of seduction, the dark twin star of seduction, is repulsion. Is this religious factor the repulsion angle that you're adding to Baudrillard?
Yeah, I think so, actually.
Right. So what you wrote 14 years ago, you were able to develop once the Bush administration came in.
Yeah, I'm a slow thinker. It's taken a while to do.
Have you seen Baudrillard's book on 9-1-1, The Spirit of Terrorism?
I have, and I liked it a lot. I like Baudrillard's writing a lot. I think he's courageous. He's absolutely courageous. And he every year publishes these small books, which I just take to be these really courageous, unerringly accurate diagnosis of contemporary political history itself. He's the greatest living political historian of the present and the future. A good
right. Book. So in The Possessed Individual, you feature Barthes, Foucault, Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, and Virilio. You do, in the end, favor and learn your most from Baudrillard, it seems.
Yeah. I learned a lot from all of them, actually.
Right, but So you would maybe, is Virilio, he would not be able to write The Spirit of Terrorism.
Not in the same way. He's written on it, but not in the same way.
Well, do you find Baudrillard's more perceptive or just more unique?
No, they're thought really, they have differences in terms of understanding symbolic exchange, but their thought runs parallel to one another in terms of the effects of metabolic domination.
Right.
Virilio's thesis is that the language of domination today is no longer simply like domination on the outside, but literally the language of the state drills down into human bodies. It's like a metabolic domination. It literally, the state wishes to hijack human bodies and hijack perception. It's called like the war on terror and things like this.
Right, so you look at these seven writers as parallel particles. That's how you deal with it.
Yeah, I guess that's a nice way of putting it, sure.
Yeah, so in the Spirit of Terrorism, he says basically, Eben, that we dreamed the destruction of the Twin Towers. We needed that release from the globalized space-time fabric, and we all dreamed for it, and it happened. Isn't that a simple way to sum it up, Arthur? That, I mean, that's what he said.
Yes, I guess.
Did you dream it, Evan?
It's not quite what he said.
He does say we dream it, but, you know, it's a lot more complex, but he says we yearn for this. We did it to ourselves. And even the Twin Towers suicided themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Baudrillard's great, because Baudrillard long ago had this sense. We once did a cover, you know, which is motivated when we did a journal. And we put Elvis Presley before when he died and stuff like on the cover and put two images of Elvis. We put, you know, the young Adonis-like Elvis, you know, handsome guy and stuff like this. And then we put, you know, the National Enquirer Elvis, the fat Elvis, and put under it and did it all in, like, shocking pink. And put cynical sign under it, and put a Baudrillard quote, which was, you know, that we're living in a culture which is like a cracked windshield, and we want to go faster and faster, because who wants stability? Everyone wants the crash. And that's Baudrillard's sense about the Twin Towers, of which, by the way, in a wonderful book called Symbolic Exchange and Death, Baudrillard wrote a phenomenal, this long before 9/11, he wrote a phenomenally important essay on the Twin Towers as like the sign of the modernist period of in architecture of American capitalism itself.
Yes, I've read that. This is a great essay.
Well, you know, we're just coming up on a quick break, but just in what you guys were saying, it really seems to come back to that Puritan underpinning and that apocalypse culture, that we are so bad, the body is so bad and so evil that maybe we did dream of its destruction. We've been waiting for the second coming. We're waiting for people to be punished, finally, by the Messiah. And so maybe that kind of what kind of factors into it.
That's good.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County. I hope you guys are having as much fun as I am trying to keep up with this amazing, amazing thought forms that are passing back and forth between Arthur Croker and Bob Dobbs and you, all right? So look, we have to take this quick break and we're going to be back, so stay awake.
Where the past and the future converge. Go to www.radioalchemy.com. RadioAlchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
All right. Well, I am cutting this break short because there is so much to be had in this incredible discussion with Arthur Croker, who is the lovely Canadian chair, Canada research chair at the Pacifica Center for Pacific Center. I just keep adding all of these syllables here for Tech, Culture, and Theory, professor of political economy, and Bob Dobbs, our resident digital agent, helping us understand the bodies and beyond and how technology is much more significant to us than meets our eye because we don't see it. We just live it and we do it. Well, we do see television. I wanted to ask you guys, is there anything, I just had, and this is probably way out, but you guys can probably hone it in, but is there some difference, because we are talking about religion, and we have the Old Testament dominated by this God who slaps people around, who tells them how to set up their cities, tells them that they can't eat this and do that, and has, you know, flooded them, burnt them, turned them to salt, all of these kind of things. And then all of a sudden his son shows up in the New Testament and is full of love, is a pauper, and it's so interesting, if the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, it's amazing to see someone show up in the New Testament full of love and understanding the technology of the body and you shall do more than what you see me do and all of this versus a very vindictive God. Does that come in at all into your notion of quantum physics and how, you know, and just what's going on now? Does that have anything to do with it? I mean, which part of religion are we talking about, the New or the Old Testament, in a way?
Well, the Puritans are in New Testament. The Christian interpretation of the Old Testament is to think it's testimony to vindictiveness, but the vindictive God appears also in the New Testament.
Yeah, but
right. This is New Testament God, and it's the vindictive God that appears. But the wonderful ideas you've described so eloquently are the struggle in the religious consciousness itself between the transformative, humane possibilities of religion for community and the apocalyptic tendencies towards, you know, vindictiveness and, you know, what Baudrillard calls the evil demon of images. And those are, this, you know, this a fundamental tension between the rise and the fall is, you know, goes right, splits right back through the Bible itself. It's the code of the Bible.
Right.
Okay, I wanted to go in. There's a phrase that Arthur and his wife came up with 12, 13 years ago, the mutant runaway clitoris. I was wondering if George W. Bush, as a vampire Puritan, does that include this theme of the mutant runaway clitoris, or is there something new here, Arthur?
No, that's another thesis. That's the history. The general thesis that you can't take it out of context. The general thesis of that book was the thing called the hysterical male. Puritans were like the hysterical male, like this absolute hystericization of existence itself. And maybe in some ways you could describe a lot of contemporary politics as based on that kind of phallocentric ideology. That's what that was referring to.
Right. So the vampire Puritan, you know, Evan, you've heard of this David Icke, who seems to be very popular even on college campuses with the idea that there are these gray alien shapeshifters possessing humans. The queen is an alien.
Right.
To me, it seems that resonates with the theme of Arthur about this Puritan vampire quality, these post-human archetypes that the Puritans have brought back through the tunneling effect, and that David Icke may be describing people's horror at this retrieval of vampire Puritans. Do you see a connection there, Arthur?
Yeah, I guess so. But vampires appear sometimes in very banal forms. Contemporary politics strikes me as a lot of a politics of pedestrian quality. And also what Michael Weinstein, who's a Chicago political theorist, has described, is as much of contemporary politics has to do with the aggregation of really weak people into organized groups for the sake of taking revenge and for sacrificial violence and to gain wealth and power and things like this. Aggregations of weak personalities. And I think, on both sides of the political spectrum, that's a pretty accurate description of contemporary politics.
Right, and there's another dimension. Looking at some of the older essays, the one in 1986 on Baudrillard, you quote Roland Barthes' phrase, panic boredom. And I was struck about how you say in The Will to Technology book that came out a few years ago that you did, you talk about the boredom culture. This pedestrian political thing has to deal with the boredom culture.
I think it's true, actually, yeah. Yeah, I came back to Baudrillard. I came back to boredom because it's pretty influenced by the thought of Martin Heidegger. Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, thinking about contemporary culture, said that when you have a culture of completed nihilism, that it won't have about it this feeling of the ecstasy of catastrophe or, filled with really the energies of transformation. It'll be really a culture of boredom, and when cultures get bored, they turn vicious, actually, to try to escape their boredom.
That's good.
Yeah.
There's a couple of phrases I would ask you about. Back in the you and Michael's book, Michael Weinstein's book on the theory of the virtual class, you talk about the post-information society. How would you explain that to our audience? Most people think there's nothing but information. Do you think you could explain that?
Because the post-information society has to do with the loss of content and information itself.
Loss of what?
Loss of content of information.
Yeah.
Information culture in a traditional sociological way of thinking about it is to think of actually the movement of, a knowledge base of culture, and it migrates, circulates through culture itself. But when you have culture, it really moves at the speed of light at many different sectors of culture itself. The very quality of the sense of the essence of information changes, that its content itself, moves so quickly, gets streamlined so fast, that actually changes state into a thing called data. And when it becomes data, the data aggregates and accumulates in such vast archives, which accumulate to such an incredible panic proportions today that the only thing that scientists like doing with archives or people can do is erase the archives themselves. They literally don't know what to do with it.
Right.
I would say, when you've reached a state in contemporary technological culture where you're surrounded by data archives and where much of your life history circulates in archives you don't even know exist, and they're building up with such capacity to petabyte levels of data accumulation, and then they're being erased. And I'd say at that point, you're really not living in an informational culture in any substantive meaning of the term. You're living really in a post-informational culture, in a culture of knowledge dump or body dumps, basically.
Right. Now, is that a more radical meaning than an early phrase in the early 80s, you talked about the triumph of culture. Have you just explained the triumph of culture, or is this something even more vicious?
Yeah, well, it's more intense, that's for sure.
It's more what?
It's more intense.
Yes, but that's the beginning of it when you first wrote about the triumph of culture.
Yeah, it is.
Can I ask if it now is to, in the idea that it's in data and it's, in a sense, overwhelming, is there maybe a new information age that'll come up that has to do with truth? Because it seems that because the victors have rewritten history, but yet we have the information age, which is bringing out all these continued rewriting of who an individual was. We're going to be talking about China. And the Communist Party for the last 50 years has been rewriting the history of China. So maybe their new information age is going to be the recapturing and the truth of who they were. And that's for a lot of cultures where their histories have been erased. Is that a possibility? What does that do about boredom and about the post-information age?
Oh, no, that's a really great statement. That has everything to do with it. So in the case of China, you're really talking about trauma therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the act of trying to go back and erase, to rethink your way through to the original site of injury which is the effacement and exterminism of culture under the really oppressive weight of the Chinese Communist Party, is to really visit the site of original trauma in terms of your social, the reproduction of the question of identity itself.
Right.
That's difficult to do. It involves psychoanalytic processes of working through.
Right.
So, you know, there's a whole language and a vocabulary and, you know, which needs to be reflected upon to think about this.
Do you think that that would happen also for the dominant European culture? Because don't whites have, haven't they lost in a bit of themselves in the rewriting of their history?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yes, definitely. But the privileged don't view this as traumatic, though, do they? Until they're forced to, you know, when for example, with the United States, when the Chinese possibly change currencies, if they domesticate their funds in European currency as opposed to American, and the American dollar will take a nosedive.
Yes.
And that'll be a real moment of rewriting, a change in class structures of America. At that point, there's some possibility of, you know, like really trauma history and revisiting the site of American identity and thinking the whole thing through again. But I think these periods don't usually come up voluntarily. They're forced upon populations.
Mm-hmm.
So what the social historian Barrington Moore said, that every culture has its, you know, one greatest shining moment when it's a culture in eclipse, that brief moment when it's in eclipse before it sort of disappears into world history.
Right.
I think that's generally true.
And that seems like it'll be a very hard moment to capture if it's going at the slight speed of light, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly true.
I wanted to bring in, Arthur talks about in early 90s about Baudrillard as an astrophysicist of technological society, astrophysicist of technological society.
Yes.
But in 94, 95, when Arthur is putting out the Data Trash book, he's talking about the recombinant commodity. Are you an astrophysicist of something different? Would Baudrillard's writings include the concept of recombinant commodity, or do you think you've added something to what he talks about in Symbolic Exchange?
Well, Baudrillard wrote a fabulous book on Marx, and then his book on a critique of Marx, and had this really notion of the mirror of production, you know, really going to the base of Marx's critique of capitalism, saying, well, really, capitalism itself has shifted. It's become a sign form, and what Marx described as use value and exchange value sort of mirror one another, and they sort of move. And I think this notion of, like, recombinant commodity form sort of picks up on that notion of, you know, that there's a mirroring of culture already at the surface itself. And I would just sort of deepen that concept in some ways and say, yeah, but that also has a basis for transformation, has a possibility also for a greater peril and for disappearances and evaporations and destitution.
You guys, can you believe that our hour has flown by? I mean, geez, I know that I would love to hang out with you guys and just keep going, but I can't believe, you know, of course, time is absolutely flying, and especially when we get to sit in and listen to you two genies really break down the environment that we take for granted and say how important it is for us to get a grip on all of the levels and the quantum levels that we're living at. And so, Bob, I want to thank you so much for arranging this and making this possible, and I hope we can continue this series, Bob.
Yeah, we will. Let me just finish with one statement. Here is Arthur in 1991, 92. Now, think of reality shows that show up 10 years later. Here's the quote. So then, sacrificial power appears as a spectacular theater of television psyops on the bionic population, an aimless alternation of victims and executioners whose single political function is to provide a negative afterimage, an image reservoir of subjectivity that we insist on calling material reality for the operations of abuse value. For that is the abstract cohesion of the possessed individuals of the mediascape around the forcible expulsion of semiotically nominated victims. Amen.
And we'll pick that up the next time. Arthur, thank you so much, sir.
Oh, you're welcome.
Oh.
It was a lot of fun.
Yes, and so
Absolutely.
We will do this again. Arthur Croker, who is the Canada Research Chair at the Pacific Center for Technology, Culture, and Theory, Professor of Political Economy, Editor of the C Theory website, www.ctheory.net. And Bob Dobbs, you know where to find him at the McLuhan Institute.org.
No, we're not there anymore.
Yo.
It's now fivebody.com.
Fivebodies.com. Doggone, staying and keeping up with you guys. All right. Much love and thanks to both of you. And for the rest of you angels, stay up because there's more to come. Sherry Chung and China.
Thank you, Heather.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye now.
Bye now. Stay tuned for the second hour of Radio Alchemy on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.